HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 40, recorded Monday, November 6th, 2006. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Codesmith Tools, makers of Codesmith, an extensible template-based code generator for .NET. Hansel Minutes listeners get $100 off Codesmith Professional with coupon code HM100. Online at codesmithtools.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott and Carl discuss software architecture from TechEd in Barcelona.
Hi, this is Carl Franklin, and you're listening to Hansel Minutes from HanselMinutes.com. Scott and I are here in Barcelona, Spain.
Barcelona. Sí.
For TechEd Europe, developer.
Yeah.
It's good that you're here, otherwise we wouldn't have a show this week.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. You're absolutely right. It would have been wake up at 3 in the morning and call you in the hotel kind of thing. Where are we now? We're sitting on the... Look,
it's a little bit noisy. We're sort of out in the conference. We're in the middle of the action, trying to get that live on the scene sound.
And we definitely got it. They just pushed some food by, and we've got
cookies and coffee and bananas everywhere, and
sitting outside the breakout sessions right now.
Yeah. So what are you talking about here?
I'm actually giving a pre-conference talk. I'm here with Ron Jacobs, and we're doing software architecture.
Architecture.
Yes. We're doing basically a day of architecture. We're talking about essentials of architecture. I'm doing the essential abilities of the architect, what an architect really kind of needs to know to be an effective architect. Ron's then going to talk about architectural analysis, and then
He has an architecture podcast, does he not?
He does. It's called ArcCast.
Yeah.
If you go up to channel9.msdn.com, and on the left side there, he's got like 136 of them.
Wow.
I was feeling really, not superior, but really positive about how many, we'd done like 35 shows.
Right,
and I was thinking Bob Barker, the guy from
Truth or
The Price is Right,
Price
just retired
right.
last week after doing like 6,500 shows.
Oh, my God.
And now I'm like, well, I've reached 35. Maybe I'll get to 50, and that'll be cool. And I go and I see that Ron's got like 140 of them. I'm like, oh, well. But he's paid to do that full time, and we do this in our spare time, so that's a different thing.
So what's on the agenda?
Well, on the agenda for my stuff, we're talking about essential abilities. So I'm going to talk about security, performance, and availability. And we talk about how architecture is often kind of mistaken, I think, or given a bad name as a soft skill, right? Basically, architects write a lot of Word documents and developers ignore them.
Yeah, it's sort of seen by developers as a job that somebody could bullshit their way into, right?
Yeah, it seems like it's kind of a BS job that you hang out, you live in your ivory tower, and then dogma or Word documents kind of like in the form of Word documents come down from on high.
Yeah.
Thou shalt architect thusly.
From somebody who doesn't understand developers
but,
and blah, blah,
but
blah.
But I think, and we and Ron and I kind of propose in this day of pre-conference talks that architecture is a little bit more than that. It's more of a 20,000-foot view, and while there are people who don't think that architecture has a direct correlation between software and actually architecting buildings, I think it's actually a pretty decent analogy. I think that if you think about an architect who's building a building, he may not be necessarily the kind of guy who knows how to do his own plumbing and do his own wiring, but he needs to know what the building codes are for correct wiring, how to design a building such that appropriate pipes and wires can be put down. So while you would hope that an architect would be able to do some amount of configuring his own TCP/IP stack, certainly he would need to understand how firewalls interact with software, how network cards work. If not at the lowest level, there's a high-level understanding, just like a pilot of a plane, right? Needs to understand the fundamentals of flying if they may not understand the fundamentals of how a jet engine
does. So do you think developers make the best architects?
Well, that's a real tough one. I do personally think that it would be nice if you were a pilot of an airplane who started out as a mechanic.
Right.
I don't think it's required, but because I've seen a lot of MBAs turn into architects.
Yeah.
I do think that there is going to be a fundamental missing piece that will nail you at some point.
Hmm.
So you're really coming at it from two different angles, right? Always a fan of the little guy who comes up,
sure,
as opposed to from top down.
But if you're a developer who's got a big picture mentality, You know, you're not just doing your little piece of coding. You're designing and doing your own architecture on the fly.
One thing I do think is a rough thing that one of the guys mentioned at the talk is that he said, well, I'm allowed to do architecture 40% of the time. And my boss still expects me to code 60% of the time.
Yeah.
So that makes me think that his boss doesn't really understand the fundamentals of architecture.
Yeah.
And how much stuff needs to be involved. You have to be thinking about it at every level. So that's one of the things that we've been talking about is like security. Like how do I systematically manage security into my system at every level?
Yes.
Architects, I think if they are explicitly called out as architects and the project understands that so-and-so is the project architect, this is an individual who can explain not just to the developers but also to the business why we need to think about security ahead of time. We need to think about performance ahead of time.
Yeah.
So we're talking about that. We're talking about things like threat modeling. Threat modeling is an important step that I'm seeing more and more, but there's just not enough, right? Not enough people are doing threat modeling. Sitting down and actually saying, if I were a bad guy, what would happen?
Yeah.
For example, things like reducing attack surface.
Yeah.
Doing defense in depth, really thinking about I'm gonna take a pause here because we're here at TechEd and there's a random TechEd guy is taking a picture of us because he saw two nerds with microphones.
So nerds with microphones.
They must be doing something interesting. So we're talking about things about reducing the attack surface, right? And we have some pretty good examples, actually. There was an interesting WebDAV security exploit about 4 years ago.
WebDAV being the Exchange.
Exactly, WebDAV
interface.
And also what SharePoint uses to talk to the back end. And we talk about how this particular exploit was not did not necessarily affect Windows 2003. You had to patch NT4, you had to patch 2000, you had to patch XP.
Yeah.
And the reason was kind of many-fold because they had put in a layered architecture inside of Windows 2 or 2003. So, for example, there was that big security push. Remember when Microsoft stopped everything and started doing security stuff?
SP2.
So they patched a number of things in the underlying DLLs. But let's assume that they didn't. IIS6 isn't even running by default on 2003. So if you ordinarily you have to turn that off. You have to harden the server yourself.
Yeah, they locked it all down.
It locked it down by default. So let's just say that they didn't. Well, even if it was running, WebDAV isn't enabled. It's one of the things about IIS7. You know, you have to I've deployed a number of things and said, why isn't this working? Oh, I got to turn on ASP.NET. It's off by default. So even if it was on by default, the maximum length of an URL is 16K, which I think is still too long. You needed 64+K to get this particular exploit. And even if that was long enough, they had the special buffer overflow code switch when they compiled the C++, so the system would have halted that process if it detected an overflow. And even if it didn't, and if they did succeed to execute malicious code, it would have occurred under a least privileged account. So there's an example of six different layers where security is preventing that exploit from happening.
Yeah. Now, is it getting in the way of real progress, of real code?
So what's the most secure system, right? It's one that's unplugged or shut off.
That's right.
And that's really kind of the thing. It is very difficult to design and architect a system that is both very, very usable, very, very secure.
Yes.
But it really comes down to understanding the requirements. What is the system supposed to do and make it as secure as it possibly can while still allowing people to do their jobs, right? One of the things we have to do at Krillion is design systems that can't be hacked by people who work for the bank that we're designing for.
That's a pretty good criteria.
Let's imagine a guy has the SA password, right? How do you prevent things against that guy?
Wow.
Right, so, you know, doing things like encrypting users' passwords different for every user as opposed to using master keys for everything. Just so worst he could do is, you know, cause himself pain but no one else.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Right.
Keeping systems really, really locked down. We're working on some stuff at Krillion now where people will not have remote desktop access to boxes. Like, they'll only be administratable over a single port. Stuff like that. Reducing the attack surface of the overall solution.
Developers typically react in a negative way when you take away their freedoms, don't they?
They
do. So, I mean, this is a being an architect and communicating with developers and having those meetings to say, yeah, I'm going to have to de-escalate your privileges. Yeah, that'd be great.
I think that Vista will make that easier because you can always become admin.
You can blame Vista.
The issue
right?
with not running as admin on an XP is that often you're they don't give you the admin password.
Right.
That's different than I think what Vista has done, which is the just-in-time admin.
Yes.
Right. User access control. Be admin when I need to. I think that makes a difference.
I think that's much better.
One of the other things that we talk about in this particular session is availability and the concept of sequential dependencies. That the idea is that you've got all these different layers in your system, and your system is only as available as the least available piece.
Right.
So if you've got a database server, a network, a web server, a desktop, and they're all, say, 95, 96, 98% available, you have to do the math. You have to actually multiply those availability numbers by each other. And you end up saying, well, I've got a database server that's 98% available and a network and a web server. Mm. In this example here, using four different layers, I came up with an availability number of around 90%. So even though each item had availability numbers in excess of 96%, the net availability was less than 90. But then if you take some of the fundamentals of availability and you add like a redundant server, in this instance, I'll add another database server with 98% uptime, I can raise the availability of the entire system by, in this case, 2% by just adding another box. Huh. Seems like it's kind of dry, but it would actually allow a dry topic, but it would allow you to go to a boss and say, I can get your availability numbers up 2%, and it's going to cost you $5,000 for the server and this much, da-da-da-da-da.
Right.
So the idea being that an architect needs to be able to go to the business owner and put numbers
right
on solutions and say, I can't guarantee you 3 nines of uptime without this much money. And that really helps the business owners make the right kind of decisions.
You know, the architecture gig is sort of been touted by, you know, people in the industry as a cure for, you know, job security as a developer. Because, you know, a lot of development has been outsourced. It's come back and it goes, comes and goes. But outsourcing is always a threat to, you know, the developer. But architecture is something that we tend to keep in-house. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think you're right. Not because it's necessarily for job security, but I think that the architect really is that bridge between the business owner or the, we'll call the product owner and the team. Certainly one could outsource an architect if the architect oversees really where we are. Because
right.
we're overseas.
Yeah, yeah.
If the architect really had an understanding of the business.
Right.
Right. So I don't think that it's you're job-proofed. You're outsourced-proofed.
Do you know of any outsourced architecture gigs? I mean,
I don't personally, but I'm sure that there
are. I haven't heard of any.
I know that there's, you know, this is the thing. There's a lot of smart people in the world. It'd be interesting to know if there a company, other than some of these global things like IBM, certainly IBM Global Consulting has architects everywhere. Where they specialize in outsourcing architectural level stuff. I don't know. I bet you there is, and we'll hear from the listeners.
Yeah, if you hear from, if you know of any, send them. Yeah. Send them to us. Let us know.
Certainly places like ThoughtWorks will travel all over the world and work on Thought and IBM, you know. But building an entire practice of architects would require deep understanding not only of just general .NET stuff or general Java stuff, but like in my instance, banking.
Right.
You know, we met with a number of large banks this last week. My boss and I, the CTO, were flying all over the place. And we always talk to them about engaging with us, not just at my level, at the architect level, but what we call solutions architect level. Sometimes the banks will say, oh, we want Scott. He's the chief architect. He should be able to talk about this.
Right.
But I haven't personally coded against a Hogan mainframe, but I've got a half a dozen guys at Krillion that do, that are solutions architects that know how to make these things happen. So within architecture itself, there are different specializations. I'm certainly not the guy to architect to design. Well, here's where we get from architecture into design, right?
Yeah.
I'm not going to design a database,
right?
But I can architect a system that includes a database, which calls back to the construction example, right? I really shouldn't be laying the cords out and putting the pipe down.
Right.
But I do have an understanding of some of the regulatory and compliance issues and the permits that are going to be required to do that kind of work. And that's kind of the essence of what we're talking about.
So what else are you talking about in your talk here, which is coming right up, right?
Actually, I need to get going. It's going to start pretty soon. We're also going to talk about kind of the essentials that one requires for an architectural review. You know, doing things like viability assessments and all the different illities that one requires.
Illities.
So, illities, like functionalities abilities. And ability and reliability, usability. There's an ISO standard that's ISO 9126 that talks about designing an architecture and functionality, reliability, usability, efficiency, ility.
Yeah, I was going to say it's not an ility.
Maintainability and portability, all different things that a good architecture should potentially meet. Huh. So we talk about all the different things that one should keep track of. Sometimes it becomes a little dry because it's an ISO standard. It's really just a glorified checklist with a document behind it.
Right.
But actually in the talk that I'll be doing in about 10 minutes here, we talk about all these different illities, and then I apply them to the iPod to see, is the iPod an example of good architectural quality, right? Is it functional? Is it reliable? Is it mature? Is it usable? You know, is it usable? Is it maintainable?
And so what's the verdict?
Well, it's actually pretty darn good. It's a pretty awesome product. Certainly it's on, like, what, version 5 now?
Yeah.
Certainly, if any of the if only I had a version 5 iPod, maybe one of the listeners would like to take pity on me and send me an iPod to replace my next generation iPod, or what is it, generation 3? This is the ancient iPod from 2 years ago. It died on the plane. It started screaming. I don't know
really?
What happened. The little hard drive inside just started screaming. Yeah, and now I have the sad iPod face.
Jeff Maciolek, who is the engineer for .NET Rocks, and he's on Mondays too, he told a story on Mondays about his, I think it was a Creative Zen.
Yeah.
You know those things?
Yeah, that's the competitor.
No, it wasn't even a Creative Zen. It was before that. It was some other thing.
Was it a Rio?
Remember. Yeah, Rio.
Yeah, that
Rio
was the,
Karma.
That was it. The Rio Carbon. That was the thing.
Yeah, so he had a Rio Karma, and it started doing this click, 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 yeah. click, click, click,
click,
zzz, click, 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 zzz,
yeah.
stuff. He goes on the web, and he finds out that the solution to this is to hold it in your left hand and slam it in a certain way into the palm of your right hand, or vice versa if you're left-handed, right-handed, and do this repeatedly, and then it will boot up because the head was sticking.
And he fixed it?
And he fixed it. He, like, booted it up. And
see?
So he followed the recommended procedures for fixing this.
Exactly. That would be under the bullet reliability, sub-bullet recoverability.
Recoverability.
Right?
Yeah.
Architected for recoverability. Smack it hard enough, and it will eventually come back.
That's right. All right, Scott, good luck with your talk.
I appreciate it.
We'll see you next week on Hansel Minutes.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.